Chapter 4. The Happiness Visible in This Present Life. Introduction. Is it the case, as some scholars hold, that the Buddha's original message was exclusively one of world-transcending liberation, with little relevance for people stuck in the routines of worldly life? Did the ancient Buddhists believe that it was only in the monastery that the real practice of the Dhamma began, and that only those who left the world were considered proper receptacles of the teaching? Did the Buddha's teachings for the laity have no more than a token significance? Were they mainly injunctions to acquire merit by offering material support to the monastic order and its members so that they could become monks and nuns, preferably monks, in future lives, and then get down to the real practice? At certain periods, in almost all traditions, Buddhists have lent support to the assumptions that underlie these questions. They have spurned concern with the present life and dismissed the world as a valley of tears, a deceptive illusion, convinced that the sign of spiritual maturity is an exclusive focus on emancipation from the round of birth and death. Monks have sometimes displayed little interest in showing those still stuck in the world how to use the wisdom of the Dhamma to deal with the problems of ordinary life. Householders, in turn, have seen little hope of spiritual progress in their own chosen mode of life and have thus resigned themselves merely to gaining merit by offering material support to the monks. While the Nikayas reveal the crown of the Buddha's teachings to lie in the path to final release from suffering, it would be a mistake to reduce the teachings, so diverse in the original sources, to their transcendent pinnacle. We must again recall the statement that a Buddha arises for the welfare of the multitude, for the happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the good, welfare, and happiness of devas and humans. Page 50. The function of a Buddha is to discover, realize, and proclaim the Dhamma in its full range and depth, and this involves a comprehensive understanding of the varied applications of the Dhamma in all its multiple dimensions. A Buddha not only penetrates to the unconditioned state of perfect bliss that lies beyond samsara, outside the pale of birth, aging, and death, he not only proclaims the path to full enlightenment and final liberation, but he also illuminates the many ways the Dhamma applies to the complex conditions of human life for people still immersed in the world. The Dhamma, in its broadest sense, is the immanent invariable order of the universe in which truth, lawful regularity, and virtue are inextricably merged. This cosmic Dhamma is reflected in the human mind as the aspiration for truth, spiritual beauty, and goodness. It is expressed in human conduct as wholesome bodily, verbal, and mental action. The Dhamma has institutional embodiments as well as expressions in the lives of individuals who look upon it as their source of guidance in the proper conduct of life. These embodiments are both secular and spiritual. Buddhist tradition sees the responsibility for upholding the Dhamma in the secular domain as falling to the legendary wheel-turning monarch, Raja Kakavati. The wheel-turning monarch is the benevolent ruler who governs his kingdom in accordance with the highest ethical norms, Dhammiko Dhammaraja, and thereby peacefully unites the world under a reign of universal justice and prosperity. As text 4.1.1 shows, within the spiritual domain, the Buddha is the counterpart of the wheel-turning monarch. Like the latter, the Buddha relies on the Dhamma and reveres the Dhamma. But, whereas the wheel-turning monarch relies upon the Dhamma as principle of righteousness to rule his kingdom, the Buddha relies upon the Dhamma as ethical and spiritual norm to teach and transform human beings and guide them toward proper conduct of body, speech, and mind. Neither the wheel-turning monarch nor the Buddha creates the Dhamma they uphold, yet neither can perform their respective functions without it. For the Dhamma is the objective, impersonal, ever-existent principle of order that serves as the source and standard for their respective policies and promulgations. As the king of the Dhamma, the Buddha takes up the task of promoting the true good, welfare, and happiness of the world. He does so by teaching the people of the world how to live in accordance with the Dhamma and behave in such a way that they can attain realization of the same liberating Dhamma that he realized through his enlightenment. The Pali commentaries demonstrate the broad scope of the Dhamma by distinguishing three types of benefit that the Buddha's teaching is intended to promote, graded hierarchically according to their relative merit. 1. Welfare and happiness directly visible in this present life. Ditta Dhamma Hita Sukha. Attained by fulfilling one's moral commitments and social responsibilities. 2. Welfare and happiness pertaining to the next life. Samparayika Hita Sukha. Attained by engaging in meritorious deeds. 3. The ultimate good or supreme goal. Paramattha. Nibbana, final release from the cycle of rebirths, attained by developing the Noble Eightfold Path. While many Western writers on early Buddhism have focused on this last aspect as almost exclusively representing the Buddha's original teaching, a balanced presentation should give consideration to all three aspects. Therefore, in this chapter and those to follow, we will be exploring texts from the Nikayas that illustrate each of these three facets of the Dhamma. The present chapter includes a variety of texts on the Buddha's teachings that pertain to the happiness directly visible in this present life. The most comprehensive Nikaya text in this genre is the Sigalaka Sutta, DN 31, also known as the Singalovada Sutta, sometimes called the layperson's code of discipline. The heart of this sutta is the section on worshipping the six directions. Text 4, 1, 2, in which the Buddha freely reinterprets an ancient Indian ritual, infusing it with a new ethical meaning. The practice of worshipping the six directions, as explained by the Buddha, presupposes that society is sustained by a network of interlocking relationships that bring coherence to the social order when its members fulfill their reciprocal duties and responsibilities in a spirit of kindness, sympathy, and goodwill. The six basic social relationships that the Buddha draws upon to fill out his metaphor are parents and children, teacher and pupils, husband and wife, friend and friend, employer and workers, lay follower, and religious guides. Each is considered one of the six directions in relation to its counterpart. For a young man like Sigalaka, his parents are the east, his teachers are the south, his wife and children the west, his friends the north, his workers the nadir, and religious guides the zenith. With his customary sense of systematic concision, the Buddha ascribes to each member of each pair five obligations with respect to his or her counterpart. When each member fulfills these obligations, the corresponding direction comes to be at peace and free from fear. Thus, for early Buddhism, the social stability and security that contribute to human happiness are most effectively achieved when every member of society fulfills the various duties that befall them as determined by their social relationships. Each person rises above the demands of narrow self-interest and develops a sincere, large-hearted concern for the welfare of others and the greater good of the whole. From this general code of lay Buddhist ethics, we turn to texts that offer more specific points of advice, beginning with a selection of suttas on the family. This has separate sections on parents and children, 4, 2, 1, and husbands and wives, 4, 2, 2. In keeping with the norms of Indian society, in fact, of virtually all traditional agrarian societies, the Buddha regards the family as the basic unit of social integration and acculturation. It is especially the close, loving relationship between parents and children that fosters the virtues and sense of humane responsibility essential to a cohesive social order. Within the family, these values are transmitted from one generation to the next, and thus a harmonious society is highly dependent on harmonious relations between parents and children. The Buddha emphasizes filial piety. Text 4.2.1a. And the gratitude of children to their parents. A debt they can adequately repay only by establishing their parents in the proper Dhamma. Text 4.2.1b. Wholesome relations between parents and children depend in turn upon the mutual affection and respect of husband and wife, and thus the Buddha also offers guidelines for proper relationships between married couples. These again emphasize a common commitment to ethical conduct and spiritual ideals. Of special interest to us, at a time when many marriages end so soon in divorce, is the Buddha's advice to the loving couple, Nakulapita and Nakulamata. Text 4.2.2b. On how the love between a husband and his wife can be sustained so strongly that they can be reunited in their future lives. This discourse also shows that far from demanding that his lay disciples spurn the desires of the world, the Buddha was ready to show those still under the sway of worldly desire how to obtain the objects of their desire. The one requirement he laid down was that the fulfillment of desire be regulated by ethical principles. Next come a number of texts dealing with different aspects of household life, united by an emphasis on right livelihood. Two characteristics of the Buddha's injunctions to his lay followers regarding the pursuit of mundane happiness stand out from these texts. First, in seeking the good visible in this present life, the lay follower should consistently adhere to principles of right conduct, especially to the five precepts and the rules of right livelihood. Thus, for example, he stipulates that wealth must be acquired by energetic striving, righteous wealth righteously gained. Text 4.3. Again, he asks his lay followers to use the wealth they obtain not only to gratify themselves, but also to benefit their dependents and others who live on charity, particularly virtuous ascetics and Brahmins. Text 4.4.2. Second, the lay follower should not rest content with the mere pursuit of temporal well-being and happiness, but should also seek the well-being and happiness pertaining to the future life. This is to be done by fostering those qualities that lead to a happy rebirth and the attainment of Nibbana. According to texts 4.3 and 4.5, the principal virtues a lay follower should possess leading to future welfare are 1. Faith in the Buddha as the enlightened one. 2. Moral discipline as unbroken observance of the five precepts. 3. Generosity as application to charity, giving, and sharing. And 4. Wisdom as insight into the arising and passing away of phenomena. For early Buddhism, the ideal householder is not merely a devout supporter of the monastic order, but a noble person who has attained at least the first of the four stages of realization, the fruition of stream entry, sotapatti. Finally, with section 6, we come to a selection of texts on the community. I use this word to refer broadly to both the sangha, the monastic order, and the civil society in which any branch of the monastic order must be rooted. From the Nikayas, it is clear that while the Buddha principally aimed at guiding people toward moral and spiritual progress, he was fully aware that their capacity for moral and spiritual development depends upon the material conditions of the society in which they live. He actually realized that when people are mired in poverty and oppressed by hunger and want, they will find it hard to hold to a path of moral rectitude. The sheer pain of hunger and the need to ward off the elements and provide for their families will compel them to stoop to types of behavior they would avoid if they could obtain fair employment and adequate remuneration for their services. Thus, he saw that the provision of economic justice is integral to social harmony and political stability. The first two texts included here prescribe two sets of guidelines for the monastic order. Both are excerpts from a long discourse the Buddha spoke shortly after the death of Mahavira, the leader of the Jains. According to the Nikayas, following their leader's death, The Jain monastic order was already beginning to split up, and the Buddha must have felt compelled to lay down guidelines to protect his own order from sharing the same fate after his passing. Text 4.6.1 enumerates six qualities that lead to quarrels and disputes, which the monks should be wary of and strive to eliminate when they discover them within themselves. Although these guidelines are laid down for the monks, they can easily be given a wider application to any organization, secular or religious, for it is the same six factors that lie at the bottom of all conflicts. The positive counterpart to this set of cautionary guidelines is text 4.6.2, which enumerates six principles of cordiality that lead to love, respect, and harmony among the members of the community. Again, with appropriate adaptation, these principles, loving acts of body, speech and mind, sharing of possessions, common observance of precepts, and unity of views, can be given an extended application beyond a monastic order to the wider community. The same sutta provides more detailed guidelines for preserving harmony in the monastic order after the Buddha's death, but these deal with aspects of monastic discipline too specialized for the present anthology. Text 4.6.3. A long excerpt from the Asalayana Sutta captures the Buddha in debate with a precocious Brahmin pundit about the Brahmin's claims on behalf of the caste system. In the Buddha's age, the caste system was only beginning to take shape in northeast India and had not yet spawned the countless subdivisions and rigid regulations that were to manacle Indian society through the centuries. Society was divided into four broad social classes. The Brahmins, who performed the priestly functions prescribed in the Vedas, the Khatiyas, the nobles, warriors, and administrators, the Vaisas, the merchants and agriculturalists, and the Sudas, the menials and serfs. There were also those outside the pale of the four main classes, who were regarded as even lower than the Sudas. From the Nikayas, it appears that the Brahmins, while vested with authority in religious matters, had not yet attained the unchallengeable hegemony they were to gain after the appearance of such works as the Laws of Manu, which laid down the fixed rules of the caste system. They had, however, already embarked on their drive for domination over the rest of Indian society, and did so by propagating the thesis that Brahmins are the highest caste, the divinely blessed offspring of Brahma, who are alone capable of purification. Contrary to certain popular notions, the Buddha did not agitate for the abolition of the Indian class system and attempt to establish a classless society. Within the Sangha, however, all caste distinctions were abrogated from the moment of ordination. People from any of the four social classes who went forth under the Buddha renounced their class titles and prerogatives, becoming known simply as disciples of the Sakyan son, that is, of the Buddha, who was from the Sakyan clan. Whenever the Buddha and his disciples confronted the Brahmins' claim to superiority, they argued vigorously against them. As our text shows, the Buddha maintained that all such claims were groundless. Purification, he contended, was the result of conduct, not of birth, and was thus accessible to those of all four castes. The Buddha even stripped the term Brahmin of its hereditary accretions, and hearkening back to its original connotation of holy man, defined the true Brahmin as the Arahant. See Majjhima Nikaya 98, not included in this anthology. The next two selections suggest guidelines for political administration. During the Buddha's time, two distinct forms of government prevailed among the states of northern India in which the Buddha moved and taught: monarchical kingdoms and tribal republics. As a spiritual teacher, the Buddha did not prefer one type of government to the other, nor did he actively interfere in affairs of state, but his followers included leaders from both types of state, and thus he occasionally offered them guidance intended to ensure that they would govern their realms in accordance with ethical norms. The opening scene of the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the narrative of the Buddha's last days, text 4.6.4, gives us a glimpse into this tumultuous phase of Indian history, when Magadha, the rising star among the northern monarchies, was expanding in influence and absorbing its neighboring tribal republics. In the passage reproduced here, we see King Ajatasattu, the ruler of Magadha, setting his sights on the Vajjayan Confederacy, the largest and best organized of the tribal republics. When the sutta opens, he sends his chief minister to inquire from the Buddha whether he has any chance of success in waging war against the Vajjayans. The Buddha questions Ananda about 7 conditions of social stability that he had earlier taught the Vajjayans, concluding that, as long as they keep to these 7 principles, as long as these principles remain in force, the Vajjayans may be expected to prosper and not decline. He then convenes a meeting of the monks and teaches them 7 analogous principles of stability applicable to the monastic order. Since the eventual triumph of the monarchical type of government seemed inevitable, the Buddha sought to establish a model of kingship that could curb the arbitrary exercise of power and subordinate the king to a higher authority. He did so by setting up the ideal of the wheel-turning monarch, the righteous king who rules in compliance with the Dhamma, the impersonal law of righteousness. See Text 4, 1-1. The Dhamma that he obeys is the ethical basis for his rule, symbolized by the sacred wheel treasure. The Dhamma enables him to subdue without force all the nations of the world and establish a universal reign of peace and virtue based on observance of the 5 precepts. See Text 4, 6-5. The wheel-turning monarch rules for the welfare and happiness of his subjects and extends protection to all within his realm, even to the birds and beasts. Among his duties is to prevent crime from erupting in his kingdom, and to keep the kingdom safe from crime, he must give wealth to those in need. For in the view of the Nikayas, poverty is the breeding ground of criminality. This theme, mentioned among the duties of the wheel-turning monarch in Text 4, 6, 5, is elaborated in Text 4, 6, 6. We here see a wise chaplain advise a king that the correct way to end the plague of theft and brigandage in his realm is not by imposing harsher punishments and stricter law enforcement, but by giving the citizens the means to earn their living. Once the people enjoy a satisfactory standard of living, they will lose all interest in harming others, and the country will enjoy peace and tranquility. Chapter 4. The Happiness Visible in This Present Life. Part 1. Upholding the Dhamma in Society. Verse 1. The King of the Dhamma. The Blessed One said, "Monks, even a wheel-turning monarch, a just and righteous king, does not govern his realm without a co-regent." When he had spoken, a certain monk addressed the Blessed One thus, "But who, venerable sir, is the co-regent of the wheel-turning monarch, the just and righteous king?" "It is the Dhamma, the law of righteousness, O monk," replied the Blessed One. In this case, the wheel-turning monarch, the just and righteous king, relying on the Dhamma, honoring the Dhamma, esteeming and respecting it, with the Dhamma as his standard, banner, and sovereign, provides lawful protection, shelter, and safety for his own dependents. He provides lawful protection, shelter, and safety for the Khatiyas attending on him, for his army, for the Brahmins and householders, for the inhabitants of town and countryside, for ascetics and Brahmins, for the beasts and birds. A wheel-turning monarch, a just and righteous king, who thus provides lawful protection, shelter, and safety for all, is the one who rules by Dhamma only, and that rule cannot be overthrown by any hostile human being. Even so, O monk, the Tathagata, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one, the just and righteous king of the Dhamma, relying on the Dhamma, honoring the Dhamma, esteeming and respecting it, with the Dhamma as his standard, banner, and sovereign, provides lawful protection, shelter, and safety in regard to action by body, speech, and mind. He teaches thus, such bodily action should be undertaken, and such should not be undertaken. Such verbal action should be undertaken, and such should not be undertaken. Such mental action should be undertaken, and such should not be undertaken. The Tathagata, the Arahant, the fully enlightened one, the just and righteous king of the Dhamma, who thus provides lawful protection, shelter, and safety in regard to action by body, speech, and mind, is the one who turns the incomparable wheel of the Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma only, and that wheel of the Dhamma cannot be turned back by any ascetic or Brahmin, by any Deva or Mara or Brahma, or by anyone in the world. Anguttara Nikaya 3.14 1.109-110 Verse 2. Worshipping the Six Directions. 1. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Raja Gaha, at the bamboo grove, in the squirrel's sanctuary. Then Sigalaka, the householder's son, having got up early and gone out of Raja Gaha, was paying homage, with wet clothes and hair, and with joined palms, to the different directions, to the east, the south, the west, the north, the nadir, and the zenith. 2. And the Blessed One, having risen early and dressed, took his robe and bowl and went to Raja Gaha for alms. And seeing Sigalaka paying homage to the different directions, he said, Householder's son, why have you got up early to pay homage to the different directions? Venerable sir, my father, when he was dying, told me to do so. And so, out of respect for my father's words, which I revere, honor, and hold sacred, I have got up early to pay homage in this way to the six directions. But, householder's son, that is not the right way to pay homage to the six directions, according to the noble one's discipline. Well, venerable sir, how should one pay homage to the six directions, according to the noble one's discipline? It would be good if the Blessed One would teach me the proper way to pay homage to the six directions, according to the Noble One's discipline. Then listen and attend carefully, householder's son. I will speak. Yes, venerable sir, Sigalaka said. The Blessed One said this. 27. And how, householder's son, does the noble disciple protect the six directions? These six things are to be regarded as the six directions. The east denotes mother and father. The south denotes teachers. The west denotes wife and children. The north denotes friends and companions. The nadir denotes servants, workers, and helpers. The zenith denotes ascetics and Brahmins. 28. There are five ways in which a son should minister to his mother and father, as the eastern direction. He should think, having been supported by them, I will support them. I will perform their duties for them. I will keep up the family tradition. I will be worthy of my heritage. After my parents' deaths, I will distribute gifts on their behalf. And there are five ways in which the parents, so ministered to by their son as the eastern direction, will reciprocate. They will restrain him from evil, support him in doing good, teach him some skill, find him a suitable wife, and in due time hand over his inheritance to him. In this way, the eastern direction is covered, making it at peace and free from fear. 29. There are five ways in which pupils should minister to their teachers as the southern direction: by rising to greet them, by waiting on them, by being attentive, by serving them, by mastering the skills they teach. And there are five ways in which their teachers, thus ministered to by their pupils as the southern direction, will reciprocate. They will give through instruction, make sure they have grasped what they should have duly grasped, give them a thorough grounding in all skills, recommend them to their friends and colleagues, and provide them with security in all directions. In this way, the southern direction is covered, making it at peace and free from fear. 30. There are five ways in which a husband should minister to his wife as the western direction: by honoring her, by not disparaging her, by not being unfaithful to her, by giving authority to her, by providing her with adornments. And there are five ways in which a wife, thus ministered to by her husband as the Western direction, will reciprocate: by properly organizing her work, by being kind to the servants, by not being unfaithful, by protecting stores, and by being skillful and diligent in all she has to do. In this way, the Western direction is covered, making it at peace and free from fear. 31. There are five ways in which a man should minister to his friends and companions as the Northern direction: by gifts, by kindly words, by looking after their welfare, by treating them like himself, and by keeping his word. And there are five ways in which friends and companions, thus ministered to by a man as the Northern direction, will reciprocate: by looking after him when he is inattentive, by looking after his property when he is inattentive, by being a refuge when he is afraid, by not deserting him when he is in trouble, and by showing concern for his children. In this way, the Northern direction is covered, making it at peace and free from fear. 32. There are five ways in which a master should minister to his servants and workers as the nadir: by arranging their work according to their strength, by supplying them with food and wages, by looking after them when they are ill, by sharing special delicacies with them, and by letting them off work at the right time. And there are five ways in which servants and workers, thus ministered to by their master as the nadir, will reciprocate. They will get up before him, go to bed after him, take only what they are given, do their work properly, and be bearers of his praise and good repute. In this way, the nadir is covered, making it at peace and free from fear. 33. There are five ways in which a man should minister to ascetics and Brahmins as the zenith: by kindness in bodily deed, speech, and thought, by keeping open house for them, and by supplying their bodily needs. And the ascetics and Brahmins, thus ministered to by him as the zenith, will reciprocate in five ways. They will restrain him from evil, encourage him to do good, be benevolently compassionate toward him, teach him what he has not heard, and point out to him the way to heaven. In this way, the zenith is covered, making it at peace and free from fear. From Digha Nikaya, 31. Sigalaka Sutta, 3, 180 through 181, 187 through 191. Part 2. The Family. Verse 1. Parents and Children. A. Respect for Parents. Monks, those families dwell with Brahma, where at home the parents are respected by their children. Those families dwell with the ancient teachers, where at home the parents are respected by their children. Those families dwell with the ancient deities, where at home the parents are respected by the children. Those families dwell with the holy ones, where at home the parents are respected by their children. Brahma, monks, is a term for father and mother. The ancient teachers is a term for father and mother. The ancient deities is a term for father and mother. The holy ones is a term for father and mother. And why? Parents are of great help to their children. They bring them up, feed them, and show them the world. Anguttara Nikaya, 4:63, 2:70. B. Repaying One's Parents. Monks, I declare that there are two persons one can never repay. What two? One's mother and father. Even if one should carry about one's mother on one shoulder and one's father on the other, and while doing so should live 100 years, reach the age of 100 years, and if one should attend to them by anointing them with balms, by massaging, bathing, and rubbing their limbs, and they should even void their excrements there, even by that would one not do enough for one's parents, nor would one repay them. Even if one were to establish one's parents as the supreme lords and rulers over this earth so rich in the seven treasures, one would not do enough for them, nor would one repay them. For what reason? Parents are of great help to their children. They bring them up, feed them, and show them the world. But monks, one who encourages his unbelieving parents, settles and establishes them in faith, who encourages his immoral parents, settles and establishes them in moral discipline, who encourages his stingy parents, settles and establishes them in generosity, who encourages his ignorant parents, settles and establishes them in wisdom. Such a one, monks, does enough for his parents. He repays them, and more than repays them for what they have done. Anguttara Nikaya 2. 4. 2. 1. 61 through 62. Verse 2. Husbands and Wives. A. Different Kinds of Marriages. On one occasion, the Blessed One was traveling along the highway between Madhura and Viranja, and a number of householders and their wives were traveling along the same road. Then the Blessed One left the road and sat down on a seat at the foot of a tree. The householders and their wives saw the Blessed One sitting there and approached him. Having paid homage to him, they sat down to one side, and the Blessed One then said to them, "Householders, there are these four kinds of marriages. What for? A wretch lives together with a wretch. A wretch lives together with a goddess. A god lives together with a wretch. A god lives together with a goddess. And how does a wretch live together with a wretch? Here, householders, the husband is one who destroys life, takes what is not given, engages in sexual misconduct, speaks falsely, and indulges in wines, liquor, and intoxicants, the basis for negligence. He is immoral, of bad character. He dwells at home with a heart obsessed by the stain of stinginess. He abuses and reviles ascetics and Brahmins, and his wife is exactly the same in all respects. It is in such a way that a wretch lives together with a wretch. And how does a wretch live together with a goddess? Here, householders, the husband is one who destroys life, who abuses and reviles ascetics and Brahmins. But his wife is one who abstains from the destruction of life, from wines, liquor, and intoxicants. She is virtuous, of good character. She dwells at home with a heart free from the stain of stinginess. She does not abuse or revile ascetics and Brahmins. It is in such a way that a wretch lives together with a goddess. And how does a god live together with a wretch? Here, householders, the husband is one who abstains from the destruction of life, who does not abuse or revile ascetics and Brahmins. But his wife is one who destroys life, who abuses and reviles ascetics and Brahmins. It is in such a way that a god lives together with a wretch. And how does a god live together with a goddess? Here, householders, the husband is one who abstains from the destruction of life, from wines, liquor, and intoxicants. He is virtuous, of good character. He dwells at home with a heart free from the stain of stinginess. He does not abuse or revile ascetics and Brahmins. And his wife is exactly the same in all respects. It is in such a way that a god lives together with a goddess. These, householders, are the four kinds of marriages. Anguttara Nikaya 4:53, 2:57 through 59. B. How to be united in future lives. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Bhaga people near Sumsumaragiri in the deer park of the Besakala grove. One morning, the Blessed One dressed, took his upper robe and bowl, and went to the dwelling of the householder Nakulapita. Having arrived there, he sat down on the seat prepared for him. Then the householder Nakulapita and the housewife Nakulamata approached the Blessed One and, after paying homage to him, sat down to one side. So seated, the householder Nakulapita said to the Blessed One, Venerable sir, ever since the young housewife Nakulamata was brought home to me, when I too was still young, I am not aware of having wronged her even in my thoughts, still less in my deeds. Our wish is to be in one another's sight so long as this life lasts, and in the future life as well. Then Nakulamata, the housewife, addressed the Blessed One thus, Venerable sir, ever since I was taken to the home of my young husband, Nakulapita, while being a young girl myself, I am not aware of having wronged him even in my thoughts, still less in my deeds. Our wish is to be in one another's sight as long as this life lasts, and in the future life as well. Then the Blessed One spoke thus, If householders, both wife and husband, wish to be in one another's sight so long as this life lasts, and in the future life as well, they should have the same faith, the same moral discipline, the same generosity, the same wisdom. Then they will be in one another's sight so long as this life lasts, and in the future life as well, when both are faithful and generous, self-restrained, of righteous living. They come together as husband and wife, full of love for each other. Many blessings come their way. They dwell together in happiness. Their enemies are left dejected when both are equal in virtue. Having lived by Dhamma in this world, the same in virtue and observance, they rejoice after death in the Deva world, enjoying abundant happiness. Anguttara Nikaya 4:55, 2:61-62. C. Seven Kinds of Wives. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Savatthi in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. In the morning, the Blessed One dressed, took his bowl and robe, and went to Anathapindika's house, where he sat down in a seat prepared for him. On that occasion, people in the house were making an uproar and a racket. The householder Anathapindika approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and sat down to one side. The Blessed One then said to him, Why are people in your house making this uproar and racket, householder? One would think they were fishermen making a haul of fish. That, venerable sir, is our daughter-in-law Sujata. She is rich and has been brought here from a rich family. She does not obey her father-in-law and mother-in-law, nor her husband. She does not even honor, respect, esteem, and venerate the Blessed One. Then the Blessed One called the daughter-in-law Sujata, saying, Come, Sujata. Yes, venerable sir, she replied, and she went to the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and sat down to one side. The Blessed One then said to her, There are seven kinds of wives, Sujata. What seven? One like a slayer, one like a thief, one like a tyrant, one like a mother, one like a sister, one like a friend, and one like a handmaid. These are the seven kinds of wives. Now, which of these seven are you? I do not understand in detail the meaning of the Blessed One's brief statement. It would be good, venerable sir, if the Blessed One would teach me the Dhamma in such a way that I might understand the meaning in detail. Then listen, Sujata, and attend carefully. I will speak. Yes, venerable sir, Sujata replied. The Blessed One said this, With hateful mind, cold and heartless, lusting for others, despising her husband, who seeks to kill the one who bought her. Such a wife is called a slayer. When her husband acquires wealth, by his craft or trade or farm work, she tries to filch a little for herself. Such a wife is called a thief. The slothful glutton, bent on idling, harsh, fierce, rough in speech, a woman who bullies her own supporter. Such a wife is called a tyrant. One who is always helpful and kind, who guards her husband as a mother her son, who carefully protects the wealth he earns. Such a wife is called a mother. She who holds her husband in high regard. as younger sister holds the elder born, who humbly submits to her husband's will, such a wife is called a sister. One who rejoices at her husband's sight, as one friend might welcome another, well-raised, virtuous, devoted, such a wife is called a friend. One without anger, afraid of punishment, who bears with her husband free of hate, who humbly submits to her husband's will, such a wife is called a handmaiden. The types of wives here called a slayer, a thief, and the wife like a tyrant, these kinds of wives, with the body's breakup, will be reborn deep in hell. But wives like mother, sister, friend, and the wife called a handmaid, steady in virtue, long restrained, with the body's breakup go to heaven. These, Sujata, are the seven kinds of wives. Now, which of these are you? Beginning today, venerable sir, you should consider me a wife who is like a handmaid. Anguttara Nikaya, 759, 4, 91 through 94. Part 3. Present welfare, future welfare. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling among the Koliyans, where there was a market town of the Koliyans named Kakarapata. Then the Koliyan family man, Digha Janu, approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, and sat down to one side. So seated, he said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, we are lay people who enjoy sensual pleasures, dwelling at home in a bed crowded with children, enjoying fine sandalwood, wearing garlands, scents, and unguents, accepting gold and silver. Let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma to us in a way that will lead to our welfare and happiness, both in the present life and in the future life as well." There are, Byagha Paja, four things that lead to the welfare and happiness of a family man in this very life. What for? The accomplishment of persistent effort, the accomplishment of protection, good friendship, and balanced living. And what is the accomplishment of persistent effort? Here, Byagha Paja, whatever may be the means by which a family man earns his living, whether by farming, trade, cattle raising, archery, or civil service, or by some other craft, he is skillful and diligent. He investigates the appropriate means and is able to act and arrange everything properly. This is called the accomplishment of persistent effort. And what is the accomplishment of protection? Here, Byagha Paja, a family man sets up protection and guard over the wealth acquired by energetic striving, amassed by the strength of his arms, earned by the sweat of his brow, righteous wealth righteously gained, thinking, "How can I prevent kings and bandits from taking this away, fire from burning it, floods from sweeping it off, and unloved heirs from taking it?" This is called the accomplishment of protection. And what is good friendship? Here, Byagha Paja, in whatever village or town a family man dwells, he associates with householders or their sons, whether young or old, who are of mature virtue, accomplished in faith, moral discipline, generosity, and wisdom. He converses with them and engages in discussions with them. He emulates them in regard to their accomplishment in faith, moral discipline, generosity, and wisdom. This is called good friendship. And what is balanced living? Here, Byagha Paja, a family man knows his income and expenditures and leads a balanced life, neither extravagant nor miserly, so that his income exceeds his expenditures rather than the reverse. Just as a goldsmith or his apprentice holding up a scale knows, by so much it has dipped down, by so much it has tilted up, so a family man leads a balanced life. The wealth thus amassed has four sources of dissipation: womanizing, drunkenness, gambling, and evil friendship. Just as in the case of a tank with four inlets and outlets, if one should close the inlets and open the outlets, there would not be adequate rainfall. A decrease rather than an increase of the water could be expected in the tank. So these four things bring about the dissipation of amassed wealth. Similarly, there are four sources for the increase of amassed wealth: abstinence from womanizing, from drunkenness, from gambling, and from evil friendship. Just as in the case of a tank with four inlets and outlets, if one should open the inlets and close the outlets, and there would be adequate rainfall, an increase rather than a decrease of the water could be expected in the tank. So these four things bring about the increase of amassed wealth. These four things, Byaghapadja, lead to a family man's welfare and happiness in the present life. Four other things lead to a family man's welfare and happiness in the future life. What four? Accomplishment in faith, moral discipline, generosity, and wisdom. And how is a family man accomplished in faith? Here, Byaghapadja, a family man has faith. He places faith in the enlightenment of the Tathagata. So the Blessed One is an Arahant, perfectly enlightened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, fortunate, knower of the world, unsurpassed leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of devas and humans, the Enlightened One, the Blessed One. In this way, a family man is accomplished in faith. And how is a family man accomplished in moral discipline? Here, Byaghapadja, a family man abstains from the destruction of life, from stealing, from sexual misconduct, from false speech, and from wines, liquors, and intoxicants, the basis for negligence. In this way, a family man is accomplished in moral discipline. And how is a family man accomplished in generosity? Here, Byaghapadja, a family man dwells at home with a mind devoid of the stain of stinginess, freely generous, open-handed, delighting in relinquishment, one devoted to charity, delighting in giving and sharing. In this way, a family man is accomplished in generosity. And how is a family man accomplished in wisdom? Here, Byaghapadja, a family man possesses the wisdom that sees into the arising and passing away of phenomena, that is noble and penetrative, and leads to the complete destruction of suffering. In this way, a family man is accomplished in wisdom. These four things, Byaghapadja, lead to a family man's welfare and happiness in the future life. Anguttara Nikaya, 854. 4. 281 through 285. Right livelihood. Verse 1. Avoiding wrong livelihood. These five trades, O monks, should not be taken up by a lay follower: trading in weapons, trading in living beings, trading in meat, trading in intoxicants, trading in poison. Anguttara Nikaya, 5, 177, 3, 208.